to Straight Talk with MJ. I am your host, Michelle Jeanette. Thank you again for joining me. This is going to be probably my last episode before the election 2020. We are down to the last few days. And barring any crazy information that comes out that I might have to get to you, this will be the final episode before the election. So I've got a lot to talk about, and it's going to be a packed episode. But before we get into everything, you know, I always end with history, and I've got some interesting things about the election, about voter fraud, about, you know, the history being made this week with another justice being appointed to the Supreme Court, and a bunch of other things. So before, though, I get to that, I do have a word from my newest sponsor, On Guard Firearms. And safety has been a big issue this year, from COVID-19 to the riots to defunding the police and human trafficking. One way to protect yourself and your loved ones is to be prepared. On Guard Firearms and Accessories is a family and veteran-owned small business that offers both handguns and rifles to help protect yourself and those around you. From the first-time gun owner to the seasoned veteran, On Guard Firearms and Accessories has something in store for you. Don't wait for someone who won't get there until after the emergency is over. Get prepared now. You can check out their selection online at www.onguardfirearms.com or visit their Facebook page or Instagram page. And don't forget, when you go to check out, use the coupon code STRAIGHTTALK. And remember, Straight Talk has two T's. And when you use the coupon code STRAIGHTTALK, you will get a 10% discount. And again, go to www.onguardfirearms.com and visit them and get your get prepared now. I'm going to be talking about that here at the end of the episode, about some more information on that anyway. So this week has absolutely been jam-packed with things going on, and sometimes as Christians you can get bogged down, or anybody can get bogged down in the weeds of all the details. But when you take a step back and look at the 30,000 foot view of it all, especially as Christians, we can see that there is a huge spiritual battle going on for this, for the future and the soul of this nation. It's coming to a head this election. And we really, you know, we talked about 2016 being a crucial election, and it very much was a crucial election. But this one is just as important, or more important, I believe. And we're going to go and talk about a couple of different things, but throughout this episode, and it's just going to be a lot of information. So I'm going to try to get it in here. But, you know, my goal has always been to reach out to the Christian community. Started this podcast in January as the Lord really pushed me to do something way out of my comfort zone and speaking. And sometimes getting my thoughts and everything into one place can be, you know, it's a lot of time that I do to research and bring this information to you, because to me, the biggest goal is truth matters. And it's really hard to find the truth right now, especially in today's media. And history matters. Our American history was divinely inspired, and our children are not being taught that anymore in school. And even many, many adults don't even know the full, you know, story of our great American history. And I have been learning a lot as I've done a lot of research to bring this to you. So I try to bring everything in one place, maybe some highlights from the week that maybe you've heard already, but just to get it all in one place so you can be informed and hear the truth in one place, and especially history. So the first thing that started off this week was Justice Amy Coney Barrett being sworn in as the next justice on our Supreme Court. And that is one of the reasons why a lot of us voted for Trump in 2016, was because he had promised to appoint judges in the federal court and on the Supreme Court that were originalist, constitutionalist judges. And that has been so extremely important, because he has now appointed upwards of 300 judges across the nation in our federal court system. And she was actually one of those in 2017 that was appointed to the 7th District Court, I believe, that she's been serving at the last few years before now being sworn into the Supreme Court. And this is a win for the country. This is a win for the Constitution and our founding documents, the founding ideals of our country. But it's also a win for women. And it's interesting to me that if you don't notice this, maybe you have noticed this, I don't know. But it's very interesting to me that the feminist, quote-unquote feminist movement only seems to support and promote and celebrate women who just think like they do, which are liberal, progressive ideas. And when a conservative woman does something wonderful, like, for instance, Amy Coney Barrett, who is, believe it or not, a spirit-filled Catholic, she and her husband have 7 children, so she's the first Supreme Court justice to sit with school-aged children. She's one of the youngest, I believe, if not the youngest, at 48. And, you know, she is a constitutionalist judge. And this should be celebrated all across the nation as a win for women, especially as they push women, you know, that they celebrate women in the workplace and doing both as being a mom and a career woman. You know, you would think that that would be celebrated, but, you know, for instance, if you didn't know, the Girl Scouts came out and they posted a tweet that said, "Congratulations, Amy Coney Barrett, on becoming the 5th woman appointed to the Supreme Court since its inception in 1789. And they just put up a picture of all the female Supreme Court justices that we've had in the past: Sandra Day O'Connor, Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and now Amy Coney Barrett. And two of those are still on the Supreme Court. But what happened? the what you would call the blue check brigade, which is on Twitter. So all these people, which is the cancel culture, they don't like what you think. They don't like what you believe in, so they will cancel you. And so they shamed the Girl Scouts so much, they harassed them so much, that the Girl Scouts came out and retracted deleted their tweet congratulating Amy Coney Barrett. And you know, they said, "Earlier today we shared a post highlighting the 5 women who have been appointed to the Supreme Court. It was quickly viewed as a political and partisan statement, which was not our intent, and we have removed the post." But the funny thing is, they actually posted congratulations to other women, including Sotomayor and Kagan, in the past, but nobody harassed them for putting that up. So this is just the example of the cancel culture at work and the hypocrisy. And if you are a conservative woman, this should be celebrated. This should give you inspiration to all young women who are conservative, that even though she has undergone a lot of harassment and threats, that if you listen to any of her, interviews in front of the Senate, she talked about this being discussed in her family with her husband, about the scrutiny that their family would come under if she decided to take this position. And boy, have they come under it. Attacks on her kids and everything. It's just been crazy. But thank God she got through. It's a win for our country, and we should be thankful for that. Now, basically the same day or the next day, I can't remember, it's been a long week, another interesting thing came out that, has been coming out the last couple weeks if you haven't paid attention, but if you only get your news from mainstream media, CBS, NBC, ABC, CNN, or MSNBC, those kind of news outlets, you will not have heard of this. You won't have heard of this story. And it is the story of Hunter Biden. And it is the story of corruption in the Biden family over the last 47 years that Joe Biden has been in quote-unquote public service, the last few decades, especially during his time as vice president, 8 years as vice president. It is coming to light how he abused that power and that position, using his son as a conduit to, buy his, his power, his seat, and sell access to that to other countries. And it's coming to such a crazy time that the media has all in one, voice or not voicing it, they have refused to talk about this story. And it is extremely important because people are going in and voting for president. And we have a candidate who his son has been under an FBI federal investigation since last year. It has come out that, if you don't know the background, there was a laptop dropped off in Delaware, and the laptop was dropped off, and it was to be fixed at this computer store, and it was never picked up. It was dropped off to be fixed, and guess whose it was? It was Hunter Biden's. And it was never picked up. And the owner reached out, never, heard back, couldn't get him to come pick it up. And I guess he decided to look at what was on it. And boy, did he find out a lot of stuff. And so basically what happened was he turned it over to the FBI last fall, and never heard anything. All year, never heard anything as to what happened with it. And so apparently, obviously he made copies of this because it was seemed to be such an important information that he was trying to protect himself and his family, kind of like an insurance policy on his life, I would say. And what has happened is Monday night, or I believe it was Tuesday night, Tucker Carlson, if you don't watch Tucker Carlson, he has, the last few months, this year especially, has been really a voice of truth in a lot of different subjects and issues. But he interviewed this guy named Tony Bobulinski. And Tony Bobulinski was a man who's a businessman, retired Navy, honorable retired Navy veteran, who was looked at being hired by the Biden family to run a company. And so throughout their vetting time with this guy, Bobulinski, and their interviews with him and back and forth talking and things like that, he had a treasure trove of emails, texts, phone calls, recorded calls about the dealings of the Biden family when he found out what was their history of, like, the Ukraine deal and China and many other countries. I can't even remember them all. He was very concerned about the legality of everything and was not wanting to get involved in all this. So the story has been suppressed, the media has refused to talk about it. If you watch any of Biden's handful of interviews or rallies, if you want to call them rallies, you will see that he never denies that this happened or that these emails are real, but he just says it's a smear tactic and it's Russian disinformation. So if you're familiar with The Intercept, and I'm not as familiar with this or publication, The Intercept is a left-leaning publication that was started in 2013 by a guy named Glenn Greenwald, who helped, he was a catalyst for releasing, his name just, Oh, yeah. Edward Snowden. He was a catalyst for releasing the information from Edward Snowden. He wrote an article. He co-founded The Intercept in 2013 because of he saw that the media was censoring information. Okay. And so he started The Intercept, even though it was left-leaning, progressive. And now his own publication, The Intercept, censored his article that he was trying to write about the Biden corruption. And he was censored. His own publication website censored his article. And basically what he was talking about, and I'm just going to highlight a couple things. He said individuals included in some of the email chains have confirmed the content's authenticity. One of Hunter Biden's former business partners, Tony Bobulinski, has stepped forward on the record to confirm the authenticity of many of the emails and to insist that Hunter, along with Joe Biden's brother, Jim, were planning on including the former vice president in at least one deal in China. And Frank Luntz, he's a GOP pollster who appeared in one of the published email chains, appeared to confirm the authenticity as well, though he refused to answer follow-up questions about it. Thus far, no proof has been offered by Bobulinski that Biden ever consummated this participation, but nobody has claimed that any such deal had been consummated, but that it had been in the works. Okay, this deal with China, with and quote unquote, I'll tell you here what it's talking about. So, Kimberly Strassel is a journalist, the Wall Street Journal columnist, and she reviewed a bunch of these documents, and she found correspondence corroborates and expands on emails recently published by the New York Post, which was, if you don't know that, Twitter and Facebook had completely shut down their account, would not let them talk about this issue at all on social media. So social media giants, Twitter and Facebook, are actively interfering with an election. So, you know, all these last 4 years, they've been talking about Russia collusion. Russia colluded with Trump to steal the election from Hillary. We had a massive investigation for 2 years with $40 million spent by the Mueller investigation, found zero evidence. Zero. Everything was based on lies and paid for by the Hillary Clinton campaign. Yes, that is truth. It has been proven beyond a shadow of a doubt. So now these people, the social media giants, are actively interfering with an election by suppressing information that voters would, really vital information that voters would need to know about a candidate before going into the election. Anyway, so The New York Post included ones where Hunter was insisting that it was his connection to his father that was the greatest asset sought by the Chinese conglomerate with whom they were negotiating. The New York Times on Sunday reached a similar conclusion. While no documents prove that this deal was consummated, records produced by Bobulinski show that in 2017, Hunter Biden and James Biden, which is Joe Biden's brother, were involved in negotiations about a joint venture with a Chinese energy and finance company called CEFC China Energy, and make clear that Hunter Biden saw the family name as a valuable asset, angrily citing his family's brand as a reason he is valuable to the proposed venture. Now, if you don't remember what happened in Ukraine, while Biden was vice president, and what they tried to impeach Trump for was, you know, what you call a quid pro quo, threatening Ukraine that they would with that Trump, you know, the supposed reason was that Trump would withhold vital support, whether it be money or military support, if Ukraine didn't do something as far as getting to the bottom of the corruption of the Burisma with Hunter Biden on the board and getting paid thousands of dollars a month for doing nothing, basically. So, you know, Trump was impeached for that. But what happened in reality is that Vice President Biden and Obama withheld $1 billion, and he says it. There is a video of him talking about this. Biden actually says this, and he says, you know, he said, I told the Ukrainian guy that if you didn't get rid of the prosecutor that was looking into the corruption of Burisma with Hunter Biden on the board, if he didn't get rid of that prosecutor, the America would withhold $1 billion to the Ukraine. And he said, I'm not kidding. He said, the Ukrainian guy said, you don't have the authority. And Biden says, ask Obama. So basically, they tried to impeach Trump for what they actually did. Okay, so this is corruption, just basic corruption that was tried to, that the media tried to suppress. One of the reasons why when Hillary lost, why they went so crazy, why you see all the CIA, FBI leaders, what you call the alphabet soup leaders of the, programs in our America, CIA, FBI, and all IRS, even the IRS. So it's just a huge mess. It's so detailed that most people don't even pay attention to it because it is so just crazily complex. I know I'm not speaking it right, but it's a complex corruption issue. And so it's hard for us to follow. The bottom line is the Biden family is an extremely corrupt family, and they have had issues and ties. And if he became president, the potential is there. And the issue of our biggest enemy, China, basically owning the Biden White House. Okay. Do you understand what that would look like? Right now we're in a good spot in America because Trump is president and has been very firm with our, foreign policy issues. And that would go down the tubes if Biden was elected, especially with all of this corruption coming to light. So, even the Intercessors for America had an article on this that, they talk about Tucker Carlson's interview. I will put that link in the podcast, notes, because it's so important that you go and listen to this interview that Tucker Carlson did with Bob Alinsky. It is insane, the stuff that is coming out. So insane. So, of course, as Christians, we pray for truth. We pray for justice to be done. And because people are not finding this out because of the media censorship going on. So I've spent a lot of time on that. So I want to bring something, other interesting information going on. Another aspect of what the left is trying to do to influence this election, not just with social media giants, but election fraud. With the mail-in ballots. But there is some good news. If you don't follow wallbuilders.com, which I have promoted their information, I actually have interviewed the son, Tim Barton, is a David Barton and Tim Barton that they run this wallbuilders.com with Rick Green, who's a constitutional lawyer. And I interviewed Tim Barton back in the summer. So if you don't follow them, I highly recommend their website. They are, they have the largest private, conglomerate of historical documents. They own over 100,000 historical documents, original documents, of our American founding. It's amazing to read their stuff. I have a lot of their books and I have their founder's Bible, which I highly recommend. It's so amazing. But, they do a Friday thing where they talk about good news. And so if you didn't understand about election interference, about election fraud, the mail-in ballots, things that are going on across the nation, I wanted to share a little clip from today's episode of Wall Builders Live and their Good Friday information. And it's very important. I can't regurgitate it as well as he can. So I want to bring that information to you and want you to listen to this that he talks about what is going on across the nation with these issues of voter fraud.
I'm going to start with the Public Interest Legal Foundation. They created the type of database that Trump wanted his He created an advisory committee on electoral integrity, and he wanted that to make sure elections were real. And this is a long time ago he did that, but there were so many frivolous lawsuits by the left that it just never got off the ground, and a lot of the Democrat governors didn't want to supply information to see whether there was election fraud in their states or not. So what happened was this foundation stepped in and said, well, let's just do that. And so they obtained voter data from 42 states, and they even had to sue states like Illinois and Maine and Maryland to get what is claimed to be public data. I mean, the state, secretary of states, et cetera, wouldn't even comply with their own laws. They didn't want the data going out. Nonetheless, this foundation got information from 42 states, and what they documented was they found at least 140,000 instances of potential election fraud just in the last two elections. So it's everything from people voting illegally in multiple states to somebody voting in the name of a dead person and et cetera. So just in what they did, and this is what Trump's commission was going to do, this outside group has found more than 140,000 potential frauds just in the last two elections. So that's not the good news, but that sets up the good news because even in the last presidential debate, part of the discussion around it with pundits and, you know, Tim and I actually did election coverage after that night for an hour on one of the cable networks. Talking about the margin of victory may be the ability to get past the cheated votes because there's been so many arrests that are already happening with potential election fraud just going right now. So here's where it gets really fun. I'm going to run through several of these that have come out in the last week or so. This one starts with Ohio. In Ohio, the Secretary of State there, it involves the use of drop-off ballots. And so drop-off ballots means that rather than going into an election site where that you have an election judge and you have to show your ID and you have to prove who you are, you just pull up at the curb and do a ballot and give it to them and drive off. And you may or may not be the person that you claim to be. And so that was a potential election fraud that was seen as a way of having a lot of election fraud. So what happened was the Ohio Secretary of State issued a directive that said you can't have those kind of drop-off ballot boxes. You have to do what the state law requires. You have to be able to prove who you are. And so what happened was it was a federal judge that stepped in and said, well, that's just not right. If people want to vote, they should be able to vote. They don't have to prove who they are. And so all this went through the courts, and it finally got to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, where the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals overturned the lower federal court. And it's a great statement they made. They said the Supreme Court has repeatedly emphasized that lower federal courts should not alter election rules on the eve of an election. Great. That's exactly right. Just follow the election laws. So that's a federal court in Ohio. Here's a federal court that deals with Alabama. In Alabama, there was a five-month-long legal battle on trying to prevent Alabama from enforcing its voter ID law. This is a law that had been passed. It's a law that was upheld. The courts upheld the law. And so now as the COVID stuff has come along, you have all these election officials saying, well, we can suspend the voter ID and we don't require a witness for absentee ballots, which is what the state law required. Is if you're an absentee ballot, someone else has to attest to that so that two people are on record that that's actually you. And so a federal judge, an Obama judge, dismissed that and said, well, no, we're not going to do that because that's not good for people over 65 and it makes it harder on them. And the law actually allowed for people over 65 to have exemptions, but nonetheless, this federal judge appointed by Obama just kind of struck down all these election laws. Well, the 11th Circuit stepped in and said, no, you're going to follow the law. The law is really clear on voting and you're not going to make new rules. Here's a federal judge in Florida. And in Florida, they had a glitch in their system. They have a deadline for voter registration that was supposed to end at midnight on October the 5th. And on that last day, it went down for several hours. So the online registration went down for several hours. So the Secretary of State stepped in and said, all right, it went down for several hours. We're going to give you one more day. And that will do it. And that'll make up for that several hours. Well, group sued and said, no, it needs to be a bunch more days. Not just, I know it went down for 5 hours, but we need 10 days or whatever. And so all these groups started suing to have really unlimited registration, not follow the law. And now you had a federal judge in Florida who was a Obama appointee. He said, no, you got to follow the law. And it was really kind of interesting. He begrudgingly said, really don't like this, basically, but this is what the law says, and you're going to follow the law. So in Florida, they're upholding the law that is passed there. Then in North Carolina, you go to a federal judge in North Carolina. And in North Carolina, North Carolina officials, since a Democrat-run state, they made it possible for state voters to return their ballot without having a verifying signature. And on absentee ballots, there had to be someone else that said, yes, this actually is the person who is actually voting. And so they suspended that and said, nah, just send it in. You don't have to have a confirmation of who it is. And so what happened was they made it possible that you didn't have to have a witness. Well, the judge said, no, this is law. You're going to follow the law. You're not going to skip the law. And it's interesting that in all of these states, Democrats were arguing that voter fraud doesn't exist. It is non-existent. Well, you know, again, I started this segment with 140,000 potential cases of voter fraud just in the last two elections. And so this is the consistent argument they're using, but the federal judges are not buying this. They're not going with it. So there's just a lot of stuff happening here. One more I'll pick from Texas, down in Harris County, Texas. Texas has a state law that says if you're over 65, then we can mail you a ballot. If it's difficult for you because of age to get there, we'll mail you a ballot. But down in Houston area, Harris County, the clerk there said, well, we're going to mail every single voter in the area a ballot. 2.4 million ballots we're going to mail to people. And of course, that's a problem because there's only about 295,000 seniors in that area, but they were going to mail essentially 15 times that many ballots to everybody to make it easy for everybody to vote, except that's not what the law says. They want you to come, they want you to be there, they want you to show ID, et cetera. And so the Texas Supreme Court overturned that attempt by a Democrat official in Houston to again make the voting process unprotected. So, I mean, just starting off the first segment, there's a whole slew of lawsuits that have come in the last week or so that are upholding the integrity of the voting process. And I think that's really, really good news, especially as we go into an election where we're already seeing lots of examples. Matter of fact, Tim and I were at a meeting with some congressmen here recently, and one of the guys was telling us that he was doing work up in Pennsylvania, and in the rural parts of Pennsylvania, you register for a party, Democrat, Republican, whatever. He said, but in the rural parts, there are so many rural Democrats that are voting for Trump. And they were telling him, as someone representing Trump and working for Trump there, they were telling him that we keep getting calls from these other areas telling us, hey, you need to sign up for a mail-in ballot for Georgia. We need your vote in Georgia. And they said, but we live in Pennsylvania. We've never been to Georgia in our life. That's all right. You can vote in Georgia. And so these Democrats are actually telling this Trump official that we're getting calls recruiting us to vote in other states, to vote double states. So we know the efforts are out there, and it's really good to see judges upholding state law. Each of these states have enacted laws because they have had hearings, they've had legislative investigations that have found fraud, and we don't want fraud going on in the elections. Now, the Democrats claim that fraud doesn't go on, but that's why these laws were passed, because there was evidence of it. So the fact that the federal courts are upholding the laws designed to prevent fraud is really good news for the election. And by the way, this also goes to the point that this is what happens when you get someone appointing constitutionally minded judges onto courts who are saying, we're not supposed to legislate and make policy. Legislators do that. We're just supposed to look at the law. So this is really good news from several perspectives. One is you don't have activist judges here. And the second is that it's upholding the integrity of the voting process.
Woo! So I thought I'd bring you just a little bit of good news, but that should open your eyes to the scope and the lies, but the scope of voter fraud, but the lies that the Democrats are trying to tell you that there is no voter fraud going on. So hopefully that was some information, some good news that our judges are doing that, upholding the law and such. Did you hear the other bit of good news? I'm going to throw this in here right now. It's so wonderful that the third quarter growth reflects a robust expansion in the consumption, housing, business, investment, doubles the previous record set in 1950. It rebounded at 33%. So we had a 33.1% growth, and that doubles the previous record set back in 1950. How amazing is that? So the economy is bouncing back despite all the fear-mongering from the left of COVID. They have tried again another issue with these Democrats trying to suppress the vote because they're trying to keep you afraid and in your home. And a lot of these, some of these Democrat-run states, California, Michigan, New York, Pennsylvania, some of these others, even North Carolina, they have had some severe lockdown draconian measures. And I tell you what, I feel really bad for the people in California, especially. You've got a governor now who's coming out and talking about all the regulations he's putting on family gatherings for Thanksgiving. If you haven't read that, it is insane. that you can't meet with more than three extended members of your family. So if you had three kids, if you have a family that has three kids and they're grown and they're all married, you can only gather with two of those families. You understand? When you do gather, you all are supposed to sit away from each other, 6 feet. You're supposed to not each, when you have a buffet at the Thanksgiving table, only one person is to divvy out the food. Not everybody can get their own food. You are to gather outside. You cannot gather in your home. If you use the bathroom in your home, you are to constantly clean it. I mean, it's insanity. And yeah, they keep screaming about, you know, putting this, the media especially, talking about all the COVID cases going higher and higher. We have a spike in COVID cases. Part of that is we're testing a lot more. A lot of these people that are being tested don't even have symptoms. But the other issue that they're talking about is the death rate is way down. Okay, we have therapeutics. We're learning more about this virus. We know how to treat it. People are getting wise to the fact that these lockdowns are not, they're not working. The spikes are happening in places where there are mandated lockdowns and masks, mandated mask wearing. So it's just, you know, it's been a really crazy time. Obviously, we know the virus is real. That's not anything that we're trying to say that the virus isn't real. I know people who have had it and have survived. I know people who've had it and had mild symptoms, and people have had very, very bad symptoms and survived. So I know it's a bad thing, but if you look at the overall death rate, my husband was researching this, the death rate, just the overall death from last year versus the overall death just in America, people that die versus this year, there is not a huge difference. Okay. So what they're basically saying is, you know, they're trying to scare you with something that has a 99.99% survival, even among, especially among people under 60, but even those over 60, their survival rate is still very good. And we have more and more therapeutics going on. So don't let that scare you. Basically, they're trying to scare you not to go vote and to do mail-in voting, and where there's potential for what we just talked about for fraud. So that was good news. I'm glad about that. And it was great news about the economy. So that brings me to actually another issue. And that is something that happened that I read this week on this very influential Christian, I guess, pastor and author named John Piper. And I know a lot of people have probably heard of him. He writes a lot of good books. Seems to be a pretty solid Christian, I think, maybe, except for, in my opinion, the last few years. He has been very vocal against Trump. And so there's been a divide, obviously, in the Christian community when it comes to Trump. And, you know, so there's just been a lot of division in that. But he came out with a statement this week, and it was pretty, I guess to me, pretty disheartening and kind of shocking, because he basically, what he's saying, it was called Policies, Persons, and Paths to Ruin, Pondering the Implications of the 2020 Election, and it was dated October 22nd. So he basically goes through and talks about the difference without naming Trump or Biden, talks about the difference between these candidates. He's trying to compare the moral character of one, but not really bringing up the moral character of another, but basically comparing the moral character of one candidate with the policies of another. And he ended it by saying he's not voting for either one. And that is what really, I think, shocked me. As a Christian leader, you have more responsibility, I believe, in you know, what you say to people. You have more accountability. You're held to a higher standard of what you, how you lead your flock or your, you know, people that follow you and what you lead them into. And it was kind of shocking to me that he would not, given the implications of this election and the critical nature of this, the future of our country being held right here this week, we're going to determine if America is going to stay grounded or get back to her, grounded to her roots, or what I've heard as the ancient roots, the ancient boundaries that our Constitution set for this nation, or are we going to open the door and go walk down the path of socialism and Marxism, which in itself is anti-God, anti-family, anti-religion, basically anti everything that we hold dear as our American values. That's the options we have for this election. And the seriousness of that, it just shocked me that he would come out and say he was not voting. And the Federalist, if you don't follow the Federalist, they're a really good publication. I highly recommend them for truth. And they really bring things back to our founding documents and things like that. They had a really good article about, you know, this, what John Piper put out. And she just, you know, she did a really good job because she talks about how Piper's comparison is really not apples to apples, but it was apples to oranges. And she says Piper's framing is at best problematic and at worst intellectually dishonest, for he doesn't make an appropriate comparison. Piper doesn't just juxtapose Trump's character with Biden's character or Trump's policies with Biden's policies. Instead, he compares Trump's immoral character to Biden's immoral policies. And here is a statement from Piper that is kind of baffling to me, but here's what he said. Freedom and life are precious. We all want to live and be free to pursue happiness. But if our freedoms and even our lives are threatened or taken, the essence of our identity in Christ, the certainty of our everlasting joy with Christ, and the holiness and love for which we have been saved by Christ, none of these is lost with the loss of life and freedom. Therefore, Christians communicate a falsehood to unbelievers when we act as if policies and laws that protect life and freedom are more precious than being a certain kind of person. The church is paying dearly and will continue to pay for our communicating this falsehood year after year. Wow, that's what shocked me. That here she goes on, the author of this article, she says, it is only baffling if one first reduces conservatives to pro-life freedom lovers and then decides human life and freedom are dispensable. Freedom and life, however, are not abstract, and they are not simply a means to accomplish earthly goals or gain temporal wealth. Freedom and life are part of our imago Dei. They are gifts from God that we are to steward, and we use them in myriad ways to advance God's kingdom. So it's baffling that a Christian would think God-given sex distinctions, you know, are important. How is that baffling? Is it baffling that a believer would want to protect his family against the racially charged attacks of a violent mob? Is it baffling that a Christian would desire that his children learn truth rather than government-sanctioned a doctrine, not walking in the counsel of the ungodly? It is baffling that a Christian would desire for men to keep the hard-earned fruits of their labor, giving charitably to the poor and needy. Yeah, so basically he's saying, you know, that's what really shocked me. He's saying that life and freedom is, you know, it's okay if we lose these. We won't ever lose our life and freedom in Christ. But to me and to millions of Christians, it's baffling for him to say that, because America was founded on a divine idea that we have God-given rights of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and to worship freely, and that our Constitution was founded to enshrine those God-given rights and to limit government intrusion into those rights. And he's basically saying, it doesn't matter if we lose life or freedom or liberty, because we won't ever lose life or freedom or liberty in Jesus. But that is totally, I'm sorry, that is just totally wrong. America's the last place that you're going to find on earth that has the freedoms that we have. I know we're losing them right now. We're in a fight for them right now. But it's the last place on earth that you're going to find the freedoms that we have to worship like this. So, and to, for religious freedom and the freedom to share the gospel. Okay. It is just, that's what baffled me about this. So I pray that people, my prayer is that people aren't deceived by this and follow his lead and not voting, because not voting is voting in this election. Not voting is voting for the destruction of this nation. So I encourage you to really pray about that and just see through that deception. It just breaks my heart. Lou Engle even came out and had a response to him and was basically saying that he is wrong in this, telling people that he's not voting. He's influencing people. Okay. He has an influence over people. And that's just, it was baffling to me. So I encourage you to vote. Okay. That is definitely an encouragement for me to go vote. This election cycle has already seen record-breaking early voting. Over 70 million people have already voted. Do you understand how many? That is just insane amount of people that have already voted. So if you haven't voted, early voting here in Tennessee is already over. I'm not sure about all the other states. Everyone is different. But make a point to do it in person. They are preparing us for the idea that we will not know the winner on election night like normal, like it has been done ever since we've had, basically technology to share the election results nationwide at one time, like with TV and radio. So this is just unprecedented that they're trying to do that. And I if you don't follow Intercessors for America, they had an article out, The Danger of Wishing This to Be Over. And I'm going to read this really quickly. And then I have one more article, and then I'll close with some history. So this is written by Karen Harden. And she says, how many times have you said, thought, or heard, I just want this to be over? Referring to the November election, the chaos of COVID, the riots and the protests, etc. But in reality, that is the most dangerous comments we can make. And here is why. Let's go back in history to another volatile season found in 2 Chronicles 20. As you may remember, the Israelites found themselves under attack for not just one, but from three different armies. It kind of feels like where we are today, right? We aren't getting hit from just one place, but from a multitude, all simultaneously. Mail-in ballot fraud, media lies, big tech censorship, FBI cover-up, deep state sabotage, plus the threat to remove the president by force on January 20th if he is still in office, which I believe he will be. Those intent on takeover have said they refuse any outcome except for the removal of President Trump from the White House, even if by force. And I'm adding this, Hillary Clinton has even come out and said in video that Biden should not concede the defeat by any means. He should not whatsoever concede defeat. So this has been their goal from the moment Trump took office. It has consumed them. Many times over the last few weeks and months, it has felt as if victory would be impossible. Just like Jehoshaphat felt when attack was certain back in his day, their future looked bleak and the armies were headed their way to remove them by violence. Fear was as great an enemy as the army charging toward them. Yet I'm certain not a single one said, I just want this to be over. For in doing so, they would have sealed their own demise. Instead, they had to take action. They had to stand their ground. As we head closer and closer to November 3rd, May our prayer today be no different than the Israelites long ago as they faced the vast army intent on taking over their land. This is what they prayed. Lord, the God of our ancestors, are you not the God who is in heaven? You rule over all the kingdoms of the nations. Power and might are in your hand, and no one can withstand you. Our God, did you not establish this nation? We have lived in it and have built in it a sanctuary for your name, saying, if calamity comes upon us, whether the sword of judgment or plague or famine, we will stand in your presence and will cry out to you in our distress, and you will hear us and save us. But now, O God, here are men and women who are coming to drive us out of the possession you gave us. Our God, will you not judge them? For we have no power to face this vast army that is attacking us. We do not know what to do, but our eyes are on you. After the Israelites prayed a very similar prayer as above, the Bible tells us, all the men of Judah with their wives and children and little ones stood there before the Lord. That's in 2 Chronicles 20. And that is what we must continue to do now. We have prayed, we have fasted, we have cried out to the Lord, and we have sent the worshipers before us to declare his praise across America. So what is left? And you know, she's talking about Sean Foyt and all his multiple cities that he's gone to across his nation in worshiping in these cities. It has been amazing. He ended it last weekend with D.C., worship in D.C. We have a final instruction in order to see the salvation of the Lord. They were told, you will not have to fight this battle. Take up your positions, stand firm, and see the deliverance the Lord will give you. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged. Go out to face them tomorrow, and the Lord will be with you. Although they were told they would not have to fight physically in that battle, they were still instructed to take up their positions and stand firm, for the Lord would be with them. We stand on the precipice of history. The result of this election will determine the future, whether we remain America or become communist America. We are not to hide in fear, hoping it will all be over soon. Remember, his instruction was then and now. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged. We have been given our instructions as we remember who God is and what he has done in the past. We are reminded what he will do for us now. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged. Let's go out and face this coming day, knowing the Lord will be with us and he will give us victory. That is encouragement, but it's also it doesn't say that we're not to be in battle. It doesn't say there's not going to be a battle. The Lord didn't say, okay, I'm just going to defeat the enemy and there won't be a battle. He basically said, get ready for the battle spiritually. And maybe even physically, I don't know. But that's what we have to prepare for. And so that kind of leads me into this next article that I want to talk about. It's in, the Epoch Times, where'd it go? And it came out today, U.S. states, cities bracing for potential civil unrest after the election, threat actors could stoke social tensions. And many people have been talking about this. I know earlier this year, there was a pastor, Dana Coverstone, who came out with some dreams he had about this election and how there was going to be darkness and there was going to be conflict. And it was going to be a hard time. And I know there's been Rick Joyner who's talked about he had also had dreams about civil war and the coming civil war or whatever, that the nation would have to have it in order to get back to our ancient foundations of what this country was founded on. But then you also have Karen, the same author that just talked about this, Karen Harden. She had also came out with another article that was pretty amazing, talked about a dream someone had, and that there would be that we would win all three, and equated it to the horse race with Secretariat. And that, if you don't if you haven't read that in IFA Pray, I will put that link on there also. But basically, they were saying that there was hope that she felt like this person felt like there was going to be a huge, huge win, not just the White House, but the Senate and the Congress and all three of them. and that we were going to have a mandate to go forward and get our country back on track. So I don't believe personally that it's either or. I think it could be, you know, the hope and promise that we are going to win, but coupled with the fact that they are going to fight it. The Democrat, progressive left radicals will fight this. I mean, look at what they did in 2016. They still have not accepted the election a result of 2016, and it's very obvious. So, the Epoch Times talked about a growing number of U.S. This is happening now. This was today. A growing number of U.S. states and cities are bracing for potential riots and civil unrest after the November 3rd presidential election amid warnings that social tensions could be stoked by threat actors. And I talked about this in one of my previous podcasts. If you didn't hear that, go back and listen, because they actually have on their website, they have posted things, a schedule of how they're going to disrupt institutions and government until Biden is put in the White House. Basically, they will not accept a Trump reelection. And believe it or not, that website shut down DC. They have removed it and it's been archived because so many people are talking about it. I've talked about it. I'm nobody really, but I've talked about it. Dan Bongino's talked about it. Rush Limbaugh has talked about it. So it's gotten out there to many people have heard about it. So the Epoch Times goes on and says, federal authorities and state officials caution that Election Day and the days that follow could be marred by violence, widespread property damage, isolated violent incidents, and a long stretch of mass protests. Law enforcement agencies from states including Texas, Philadelphia, Washington, California, Chicago have said they are preparing for potential unrest, given existing social tensions. We've seen what's been happening in Philadelphia the last few days. It's insane to me that these leaders are allowing it to happen. It just tells you a lot about their ideology of allowing this kind of looting, rioting, and violence to happen. In late September, the New Jersey Department of Homeland Security and Preparedness warned in a threat assessment that a number of threats from domestic extremists and foreign adversaries that have emerged due to the Chinese Communist Party virus pandemic, anti-government sentiment, nationwide civil unrest, and various forms of disinformation will begin to converge with the presidential election in a manner not previously experienced by our nation. They went on to say about disinformation has played a vital role in the spread of inaccurate information regarding COVID-19. We've seen censorship galore of the truth of COVID-19 from doctors that are on the ground, you know, treating this versus quote-unquote CDC, WHO, health departments, health boards across the nation who are unelected people who are dictating what's going on in our nation lockdowns. The report goes on to say several near peer competitor countries engage in these types of disinformation operations to undermine the United States credibility on a global front. These include nation state actors such as China, Iran, and Russia, which are attempting to sow anti-US sentiments. It goes on and says incidents of civil unrest resulting in riots, violent acts, and fatalities will converge with election uncertainty, producing confrontations between protesters and counter-demonstrators. As a result, nation-state threat actors will have additional opportunities to spread falsehoods that can be shared by overseas government officials, public and proxy media outlets, and facilitators of disinformation. And if you didn't already know, Twitter and Facebook have already said they will not allow any kind of post on their social media platforms that says Trump has won. They haven't said they won't allow anything that says Biden has won. They didn't say that. They said they won't allow anything down there that says Trump has won on the night of election, or even the couple of days after the election. So if you try to put on there, Trump won, it will be removed, and your account may be even suspended. They won't allow it. Talk about election interference. Holy cow. So New York is preparing. Texas has the National Guard set up with about 1,000 troops to 5 different cities across the state. Chicago is also preparing for mass protests and gatherings. Of course, Mayor Lightfoot has been the worst, one of the worst mayors. Washington State is preparing with over 300 active duty members of the National Guard being called up. California is being prepared. Governor Newsom said without elaborating that the state is taking precautions to ensure the safety of its residents, to ensure the process of voting is a safe and healthy one. Pennsylvania is getting prepared. So it is ratcheting up, right? So if you maybe, you know, in light of that information, because they shut down DC website, I've talked about this before, but they want to even so far as to go and burn down Walmart distribution centers, Amazon distribution centers. They don't want people ordering things online, okay? So you don't have to get out. They don't want you being able to order things online. So these kind of things, food disruption, that kind of thing could happen. It's potential. So, you know, just be smart, be wise, be a little proactive, and maybe get a little prepared in that arena, knowing that this kind of thing is on the horizon, could be on the horizon. And when he talked about, you know, in the article before where it talked about getting prepared and standing there as God's children, being prepared for the battle, in my mind, that is kind of one of the ways you can do that, is just so you're not caught, you know, unprepared with at least that kind of thing in your home, some extra food for a couple weeks maybe or something like that. So this brings me to our final part of the episode, which is always history. And I found this fascinating article on one of the groups I'm on Facebook, and it has to do with Lance Wallnau's group that he has. And this is a fascinating article. It's kind of long, but it is so interesting that I have to read this to you. And it has to do with the connection between the founding and the Israelites. And then, you know, of course, I'll close out with that, and then I'll be done with this final episode before the election. Hopefully, right? Because it's only a couple days away. So this article I found is called American Minute with Bill Federer. And he has a lot of books out about the history of America and just history in general of the Israelites too. But it's called Ancient Israel Inspired the Right of the People to Keep and Bear Arms. And so this is the article. So I'm just going to read that, and this is real. I was just, wow, this is so cool. In September of 1774, Dr. Joseph Warren wrote the Suffolk Resolves. British statesman Edmund Burke cited the Suffolk Resolves as a major development in colonial animosity, which eventually led to the Declaration of Independence. The Suffolk Resolves stated that it is an indispensable duty which we owe to God, our country, ourselves, and posterity, by all lawful ways and means in our power to maintain, defend, and preserve those civil and religious rights and liberties for which many of our fathers fought, bled, and died, and to hand them down entire to future generations, and that the inhabitants of those towns and districts do use their utmost diligence to acquaint themselves with the art of war as soon as possible, and do, for that purpose, appear under arms at least once every week. And that was October 26th of 1774. The Provincial Congress of Massachusetts reorganized their defenses with 1/3 of their regiment being Minutemen, ready to fight at a minute's notice. That's why they got that name, Minutemen. This followed the example of the earliest known militia in history, ancient Israel, where every man was armed and always ready at a moment's notice to defend his family and his community. E.C. Wines wrote in Commentaries on the Laws of the Ancient Hebrews with an introductory essay on civil society and government, published in 1853. He said this, "Moses' constitution made no provision for a standing army. The whole body of citizens formed a national guard of defense. Thus, the landowners, or the landholders, and every Israelite was a landholder, formed the only soldiery known to the Mosaic Constitution." Denver University Law Review, July of 2013, published an article, Ancient Hebrew Militia Law, by David Koppel, in which he wrote, "New Englanders intensely self-identified with ancient Israel. From the first days of settlement in the early 17th century, Israel in the wilderness, to the days of the American Revolution, when New England's Black Robe Regiment of clergymen incited the revolution as a religious duty, and described the 13 American colonies as the modern version of the 12 Confederate tribes of Israel. Thus, ancient Hebrew militia law is part of the intellectual background of the American militia system and of the Second Amendment. Every male from the age of 20 years up and all those in Israel who are able to bear arms were obliged to fight, to go forth armed to battle. Men who failed this duty sinned against the Lord. Although God may work miracles, the righteous may never force God's hand by demanding a miracle, putting good people in danger and expecting God to protecting them." Koppel continued, "Israel's military system was based on the duty of every able-bodied male to bear arms and serve. Israel relied on a militia in which citizen soldiers would spend most of their time cultivating their farms or engaged in other economic production and would fight only for limited periods, ideally after the harvest, and only when necessary. Similarly, during the American Revolution, most men served in their state militias rather than the Continental Army. Thus, they were most able to keep their farms in production and other economic activity in progress. This was an important reason why the United States was able to economically sustain a war that lasted 8 years. George Orwell wrote in his article, Don't Let Colonel Blimp Ruin the Home Guard, published in 1941, he wrote this, "A million British working men now have rifles in their bedrooms and don't in the least wish to give them up. Even as it stands, the Home Guard could only exist in a country where men feel themselves free. The totalitarian states can do great things, but there is one thing they cannot do. They cannot give the factory worker a rifle and tell him to take it home and keep it in his bedroom. That rifle hanging on the wall of the working class flat or laborer's cottage is the symbol of democracy. It is our job to see that it stays there." David Koppel continued in his article, Ancient Hebrew Militia Law, and said this, "Another purpose of the Hebrew militia system was the decentralization of power for the preservation of liberty. The Etz Chaim, a modern conservative Jewish version of the Pentateuch, with commentary, explains this. Deuteronomy does not intend that the Israelites maintain a standing army. Instead, they are to have a civilian army or militia mobilized at times of need. Reliance on a militia rather than a standing army for military needs is another example of Deuteronomy's dispersal of power among different officials." Koppel concluded, "In Battles of the Bible, written by Herzog, a former president of Israel, and Mordecai, a professor of military history at Tel Aviv University, in that book, they summarized how the militia system preserved popular participation in the government. The people in arms formed the National Assembly of initially sovereign peoples. Ancient Jewish society never gave way to absolutism. The people always remained a body with influence on the affairs of state. This fact was instrumental not only in the preservation of the people in arms as the mainstay of the Israelite armed forces until the destruction of the First Temple in 586 BC, but also in the apparent readiness of the Israelites to bear the constant burden of military preparedness. If Western civilization can be said to be founded on two pillars of Athens and Jerusalem, the Jewish pillar matches the Greek pillar in recognizing the importance of an armed people in preserving liberty through service in a militia of all free and able-bodied men. At New Hampshire's ratifying convention, Harvard President Samuel Langdon gave an address, "The Republic of the Israelites, an Example to the American States." It stated this: "The Israelites may be considered as a pattern to the world in all ages." After Langdon's address, New Hampshire delegates voted to ratify the U.S. Constitution, being the 9th state to do so, thus putting the Constitution into effect June 21, 1788. In the ratifying statement, New Hampshire delegates reaffirmed, "Congress shall never disarm any citizen." During the Revolution, Massachusetts citizen soldiers drilled on the parade ground, many times led by a deacon or pastor, then went to church for exhortation and prayer. The Massachusetts Provincial Congress charged, "You are placed by Providence in the post of honor because it is the post of danger." The eyes not only of North America and the whole British Empire, but all of Europe are upon you. Let us be, therefore, altogether solicitous that no disorderly behavior, nothing unbecoming our character as Americans, as citizens and Christians, be justly chargeable to us. The Provincial Congress issued a resolution to Massachusetts Bay, 1774, read this: "Resistance to tyranny becomes the Christian and social duty of each individual. Continue steadfast and with a proper sense of your dependence on God. Nobly defend those rights which heaven gave and no man ought to take from us." On July 6, 1775, the Continental Congress passed the Declaration of the Causes and Necessity for Taking Up Arms, composed by Thomas Jefferson, to explain to the British the presence of militiamen from several colonies gathering near Boston. Thomas Jefferson wrote this: "We most solemnly, before God and the world, declare that, exerting the utmost energy of those powers which our beneficent Creator, hath graciously bestowed upon us, the arms we have been compelled by our enemies to assume, we will, in defiance of every hazard, employ for the preservation of our liberties, being with one mind resolved to die free men, rather than to live slaves. With a humble confidence in the mercies of the supreme and impartial God and ruler of the universe, we most devoutly implore His divine goodness, to protect us happily through this great conflict." That was by Thomas Jefferson. Boston patriot Josiah Quincy stated this: "Under God, we are determined that wheresoever, whensoever, or howsoever we shall be called to make our exit, we will die free men." Sir William Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England stated, "A man's limbs, by which for the present we only understand those members which may be useful to him in fight, and the loss of which alone amounts to mayhem by the common law, are also the gift of the wise Creator to enable him to protect himself from external injuries in a state of nature. To these, therefore, he has a natural inherent right, and they cannot be wantonly destroyed or disabled without a manifest breach of civil liberty." On June 17, 1775, John Adams wrote to his wife, Abigail Adams, about the Continental Congress's decision to declare a day of public humiliation, fasting, and prayer. John Adams wrote, "We have appointed a continental fast. Millions will be upon their knees at once before their great Creator, imploring His forgiveness and blessing, His smiles on American counsel and arms." The South Carolina Constitution stated March 26th of 1776. The colonists were therefore driven to the necessity of taking up arms to repel force by force and to defend themselves and their properties against lawless invasions and depredations. Georgia Rules and Regulations, 1776, stated this: whereas the unwise and iniquitous system of administration obstinately persisted in by the British Parliament and Ministry against the good people of America hath at length driven the latter to take up arms as their last resource for the preservation of their rights and liberties which God and the Constitution gave them. The New York Constitution of April 1777 stated this: every man who enjoys the protection of society to be prepared to defend it, the militia at all times shall be armed and in readiness for service. That all such of the inhabitants of this state being of the people called Quakers, as from scruples of conscience may be averse to the bearing of arms, be therefrom excused by the legislator, and do pay to the state such sums of money in lieu of their personal service. Rhode Island and Providence Plantations, May of 1790, stated this: all men have an equal, natural, and unalienable right to the free exercise of religion, that the people have a right peaceably to assemble together, that the people have a right to freedom of speech and of writing and publishing their sentiments, that the people have a right to keep and bear arms. Vermont Constitution, 1786, that the people have a right to bear arms for the defense of themselves and the state. U.S. diplomat Joel Barlow wrote in Advice to the Privileged Orders in the Several States of Europe, he wrote this in 1792: the foundation of everything is that the people will form an equal representative government, that the people will be universally armed. A people that legislate for themselves ought to be in the habit of protecting themselves. President James Monroe stated, of the liberty of conscience in matters of religious faith, of speech and of the press, of the trial by jury of the vicinage neighborhood in civil and criminal cases, of the benefit of the writ of habeas corpus, of the right to keep and bear arms, if these rights are well defined and secured against encroachments, it is impossible that government should ever degenerate into tyranny. America's founders went to great lengths to craft the Constitution to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, unquote. There are two ways to change the Constitution. One is tedious, requiring the majority will of the people, as outlined in Article 5, which states, whenever two-thirds of the both houses shall deem it necessary, shall propose amendments to this Constitution, or the legislators of the two-thirds of the several states shall call a convention for proposing amendments, which in either case, when ratified by the legislatures of three-fourths of the several states or by conventions in three-fourths. The other way to change to Constitution is easy. Simply get activist judges to change the definition of words in the Constitution in the Bill of Rights, and we have seen that in the last decade or even more, with these activist judges overturning the will of the people in states that vote for traditional marriage, and how they also change the wording, for instance, in Obamacare. The wording was changed from penalty to tax, not by the legislatures, because they put it forth as a penalty, but it was changed by Justice Roberts, who changed the wording to tax. That's what he said made it constitutional. So basically, that's what they're talking about, activist judges. There are recent efforts to change the definition of words contained in the Second Amendment, which reads, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Well-regulated meant in proper working order. The ACLU argued that the term the people should be redefined to mean the state militia, as it posted on its website section Gun Control. That was on March 4th of 2002. They said, "We believe that the constitutional right to bear arms is primarily a collective one intended mainly to protect the rights of the states to maintain militias. The ACLU therefore believes that the Second Amendment does not confer an unlimited right upon the individuals to own guns. If the ACLU succeeded in redefining the people to mean the state militia, the Second Amendment would read this: a well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people, the state militia, to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." The unreasonableness of the ACLU's redefinition is revealed when applied to the rest of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Because in the preamble it says, "we, the people," they would have to change it to "the state militias," right? Every time it said "we, the people," it would have to be changed to "state militias." All right, and he goes forth and it says that in Article 1, Section 2, the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the Ninth Amendment, the Tenth Amendment, the 17th Amendment. Clearly, the ACLU's redefinition of "the people" to mean the state militia is absurd. Attempts by activist judges to redefine words was warned against by Thomas Jefferson in a letter to the Supreme Court Justice William Johnson, dated 1823. He said this: "On every question of construction, carry ourselves back to the time when the Constitution was adopted, recollect the spirit manifested in the debates, and instead of trying what meaning may be squeezed out of the text or invented against it, conform to the probable one in which it was passed." Justice William Brennan Jr. explained in U.S. versus Vertigo Urquidez in, that was in 1990, "the people means the people. The term 'the people' is better understood as a rhetorical counterpoint to the government, that rights that were reserved to the people were to protect all those subject to the government." So basically, he says the rights of citizens to bear arms is just one more guarantee against arbitrary government, one more safeguard against the tyranny which now appears remote in America, but which historically has proved to be always possible. That is kind of what we're seeing now. You know, the right of the people to keep themselves protected. When you see these riots happening in all these cities, the cry of the left to defund the police, what is left? How are we going to be protected? If so, it basically would be the right of the people to keep and bear arms. That is our fundamental right to do that. So that is just a little bit of history I thought was very intriguing. I didn't read the whole thing. It was very long. I will put that on the website so you can read the whole thing. It has all the different sources listed that where he got this information. It's really, really interesting. But so anyway, thank you. I know there was a lot of information packed in this podcast episode. Basically, it boils down to the future of our country, and we as Christians have the duty to get out and vote, because we have the duty to influence and be the salt and light and influence our leaders. We are to elect good leaders. And right now we have a good, and you may not like his personality, you may not like his tweets, you may not like what he says sometimes, but we have a leader that God has anointed and appointed for this time to fight for the future of America. And he is definitely a fighter. Trump is definitely a fighter. So I, with no holds bar, will tell you to go vote for Trump if you really want the future of this country to go and stay with the foundation of our Constitution. Go vote in person if you haven't already. Go do it November 3rd. Pray. Stand firm, like she said here at the end of that article. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged. Let's go out and face this coming day, knowing the Lord will be with us and he will give us victory. So be ready, right? He said, take up your positions and stand firm. Be ready. He didn't say the battle wouldn't happen. He said, be ready for the battle. So yeah, we definitely have a spiritual battle. I don't know about any physical battle. I think there might be some in certain pockets of places. So just be prepared for that in your mind and everything. So be prayer. Don't stop praying, especially for Amy Coney Barrett, who is fantastic addition to our Supreme Court, and be praying for the election for everybody. And it's going to be up to us as Christians to make the difference. We will be the difference makers in this election. Don't neglect your duty in that. Anyways, that's my encouragement to you. And that's my word, my final word, probably most likely before the election. And we shall see what happens. It's going to be interesting. That's for sure. So anyway, God bless you. God bless these wonderful United States. God bless our president and Mike Pence and their families. And God bless the American people as they get out and vote for their future. And remember, we are to be warriors, not sheep, in all of this. As Christians, we are to be warriors, not sheep. I love that. I have a t-shirt that says that from Good Patriot. If you missed my interview with her, you can go back and look at that. But she has that shirt, you know, warriors, not sheep. We are to stand up like God is, you know, asked the Israelites. Stand up, be prepared, be ready, go vote, and make a difference. That's what we can do. That's how we can do it. Thank you for listening again. Follow me at straighttalkwithmj.net, and I am sure we will talk again later. God bless.